as a new draft resolution.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line a good friend, and certainly one of my people I really enjoy talking to, and that's James Perloff. And James has, of course, been studying the same things I have for many years. He's written a wonderful book called The Shadow of Powers Going into the Invisible Government of America. But tonight we're not going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about something that maybe even more important, and that is the very organized effort to destroy the belief of our children in God. And, of course, this really all centers around the fact that many years ago they set out to take God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, but then they also took out the teaching of creation and inserted the teaching of evolution. And if indeed evolution is true, then the Bible is a lie. It is little wonder that it's estimated that about 4% of young people today really believe in God or in Christianity. They've destroyed the faith of a whole generation of our youth, and so much of it centers around this whole idea of Darwin and what Darwin taught about evolution, and it is really one of the greatest frauds of all time that I know, because I used to believe in it. I was a graduate of the University of California, and I could tell you all about the Cambrian layers and about all the various layers and times and eras of the past. But, of course, the question is, was Darwin right? Are we simply the byproduct of evolution by chance, or did God create the heaven and the earth, as it says in the Bible? So with that as the background, James Perloff, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Stan, for having me on.
And, of course, we're going to be talking about James's, well, he has two books. One is called The Case Against Darwin. The other is called Tornado in a Junkyard. And we carry both of them because we think that both of those books are vitally important. So why don't you just tell us how you got interested in this subject and then what motivates you to write the books?
Well, I was an atheist in my 20s and finally came to my senses and came to a faith in Jesus Christ. But, you know, Stan, I still had these held-over evolutionary ideas when I became a Christian, and I'd say to myself, well, what about those ape men in National Geographic? You know, what about that stuff, you know? And then I wrote a book called What is Creation Science by Dr. Gary Parker and Dr. Henry Morris, and I was just stunned at the overwhelming evidence against evolution, which I'd never heard before. And then I got into sort of a newspaper debate with an evolutionist in my hometown in Massachusetts, and I said, well, I'm limited to 300 words here, but I got to do a little bit more on this. And so I decided to go ahead and write a book.
All right. Hey, well, we'll be right back. All right, James, go ahead, pick up the story.
Well, as I was saying, I was in this debate with an evolutionist in my hometown and decided to write a book on the subject, because I found that a lot of the books out there were very technical. They were great. They'd been written by PhD scientists, but they were kind of hard for the average layman to digest. And I wanted to kind of bridge that gap between the PhD guys and the guys that are out there. But my motivation, Stan, was I'd become an atheist as a result of evolutionary teaching in public schools, as had many of my classmates. And I realized that this was a dagger in the heart of Christian faith in America, and with so much evidence against it, I realized how important it was that people learn about this. So I've got two books on the subject. I should just clarify, Stan, the difference between those two books is just the size. Tornado in a Junkyard deals with the case against evolution in depth. The case against Darwin is sort of a mini version of Tornado in a Junkyard. It's cheaper. It's for somebody who doesn't want to read a longer book, just wants to get a quick overview, and you can read it in about an hour.
All right, fine. Well, of course, Tornado in a Junkyard really addresses all of these lies that have been told, but it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you tell it often enough, and the gentleman who's telling it, you know, has a PhD, and he's a teacher, and he's employed to educate the public, and, you know, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is when you actually stop and think of it. Why, you know, people are going to believe it, because it's said with an air of authority. And since it will have certainly the support of the people who control the mass media, the support of the people who control television and motion pictures and the great tax-exempt foundations and just about anybody who's really important other than all those radical, you know, fundamentalist teachers, I mean, who could really believe that man, you know, simply was created by God? And, I mean, it wouldn't be much better to believe that over millions and millions of years, man evolved, you know, from this very primordial form of life. Of course, they're never quite sure where that form of life came from. In fact, that's why they keep saying, well, it came from outer space. That's why we're looking, exploring outer space, because there has to be life out there, because that's where life came from. And the trouble is that there's absolutely no evidence for it. It's all a scam to confuse people. I think the most important thing, you know, is if you look at the complexity of DNA, of the genes. In fact, the more information that we amass, why, the more obvious it becomes that there had to be some sort of intelligent design. Would you agree with that, James?
Absolutely. You know, back in Darwin's day, you know, in his book, The Origin of Species, he got this idea going that life had started from some chemicals. He called it in a warm little pond. And
hold that thought. I'm going to let you just... Well, our guest is James Perloff, author of Tornado in a Junkyard, and he was just saying that really what Darwin said, that life had already started sort of by accident in a warm little pond. And you pick up the story there, James.
Sure. Well, in Darwin's day, they thought cells were simple. In fact, one of Darwin's colleagues named Ernst Haeckel, a German Darwinist, said that a cell is nothing more than a little lump of carbon. And, you know, Haeckel and Darwin said, hey, cells are small, they've got to be simple. But now we know they're anything but simple. You know, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the information content of one so-called simple bacterial cell would fill 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, you've got thousands of proteins in a bacterial cell. You've got all the amino acids, which have to be in precise order for those proteins to function. Those are the building blocks of the proteins. You need genetic code, translation devices, the ability to reproduce. There's no way that a bunch of chemicals are going to create something that complex by accident, by chance.
And certainly, the more you study it, the more you realize that this just is improbable. It is impossible. I mean, statistically, it couldn't have happened by accident. And especially when you begin to analyze any part of the human body, whether it be the reproductive system, the digestive system, the brain, the human eye, even the human hand. Certainly, I worked with that for many years and dissecting them, and really the amazing engineering that goes into just into the human hand. And certainly we see this miracle over and over again in animals and in the development of animals and their ability, even with a very, very small brain, to be able to function so efficiently and so beautifully coordinated. I wish I was as coordinated as a squirrel is, being able to jump, 15 or 20 feet, almost fly through the air from branch to branch and tree to tree, without ever a thought of falling, because it's amazing coordination. So pick up these ideas on what finally convinced you that Darwin was wrong and that the Bible was right.
Well, I'd been taught so many falsehoods about Darwin. It was really just peeling it off layer by layer. I give PowerPoint talks on creation versus evolution, and there's four major area of evidences that I focus on that demonstrate the falsehood of the theory of evolution. One we've already begun to touch on, which is the complexity of the cell and the fact that it's just far too complex for chance chemicals to have produced. But on top of that, there's some other areas that we focus on. One is the building block of evolution. Now, we're talking about genetics now. According to the theory of evolution, of course, we might just review quickly what it says. According to the theory of evolution, life began in a primordial soup when chemicals formed a single-celled organism, and then eventually these single-celled creatures began to reproduce and evolve into multicellular creatures, and they became invertebrates, which are creatures without a backbone, such as a jellyfish, which evolved into fish, and then fish yearned to come on shore, and they evolved arms and legs, and they became the first amphibians, which are creatures that can go on land or water like a frog. Then the amphibians evolved into reptiles, reptiles into mammals, and mammals ultimately into man. That's it in a nutshell. Well, how did this transition take place? You know, you can't do anything physically. Your genes won't allow you to be. So how does a fish get the genes to become a human being? Our genetic code is drastically different from that of a fish. Well, mutations were the answer that evolutionists came up with. They were stumped for a while, but finally they said, it's mutations. We've all heard of mutations. They're rare events, but they involve a sudden change in a gene or in a chromosome, which is what a gene is part of. And so the modern theory of evolution says, well, how did the fish get to be a human being? It just mutated the genes over years. You know, you get a fish would get a little bit of an arm or a leg from a cancer mutation, and that would be passed on to its offspring, and it confers such a great survival advantage, it would soon spread through the whole population of fish. Then another chance mutation would come along, and finally the fish mutated all the way into a human being, and they say that's how we got from germ to human being, was chance mutations. And evolutionists usually won't say this so bluntly, but according to the theory of evolution, Stan, you and I are nothing but an accumulation, a mass of mutations over the, many eons. Now, what's wrong with that? Well, Dr. Lee Spetner of Johns Hopkins University has written a book called Not by Chance, Shattering the Modern Theory of Evolution. Stan, what he points out in this book is that mutations always destroy information. They don't add new genetic information. They cause losses of function, losses of complexity. They never increase function or complexity. And you can readily see that in human beings. What do mutations cause? They don't improve you. They cause sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Down syndrome, hemophilia, and about 4,000 other genetic diseases. And even the so-called beneficial mutations, which are very rare, which evolutionists point to, such as bacterial resistance to antibiotics, the germ-killing drugs, even those involve deformity and loss of function. So that is another major area of evidence which is showing today that Darwin's theory is incorrect.
Well, I think that it takes an awful lot of faith really to believe in Darwin. It takes a lot more faith to believe in Darwin than in the Christian point of view that God created the heavens and the earth. But really, this is really all a matter of faith on the part of the scientists, isn't it? Scientists who rejected God, and there are really only two options. Either God created the heaven and the earth, or it evolved, because there's no in-between place. And so it really is a matter of whether if you accept God, you can accept creation. If you reject God, then you have no alternative but guard Darwin's theory. Don't some of the scientists have a little difficulty, even those who are atheists? Don't they have some misgivings about the fact that there are no intermediate stages? And with all of the research and all of the work they've done, they've never found the intermediate stages leading up to man?
Yes, there's always been a significant problem for evolution. Of course, again, as we're saying, the theory says that we went from a germ to an invertebrate to a fish to an amphibian to a reptile to a mammal. So you got to ask, well, where are all the intermediates? You know, there would have to be a lot of creatures halfway between these. For example, to go from a fish to a land creature, you wouldn't have to just mutate the right bones. You'd have to mutate the right muscles to support those bones, a whole new nervous system to control the movements of the legs. And while this fish was becoming a land creature, you'd also have to mutate a whole new breathing system so it could breathe on land. And since this, according to evolution, this happened by chance mutations, which are very rare events, as you can imagine, the number of intermediate forms would have to be tremendous. In fact, Darwin himself said the number would have to be inconceivably great. well, where are all the transitional forms? You look at the living world around us, you don't see them. I mean, you see germs and invertebrates and fish and amphibians and reptiles. They're not out there. And so the evolutionists have to say, well, they all became extinct. And you'd have to think there'd be some niche of the earth where those creatures could have survived. We also have to ask, Stan, is why aren't these creatures evolving into each other today? I mean, if it's so compelling that bacteria evolve into multicellular creatures, why aren't they doing that today? You know, the theory of evolution says that single-celled creatures evolved into two-celled and three-celled and four-celled. It kept on going. But you know what, Stan? There's no such thing in the living world as a two-celled or three-celled or four-celled or five-celled creature. They don't exist in nature. In fact, let me give you a quote from Alan H. Linton, who is a professor of bacteriology at the University of Bristol in England. He says that in 150 years of the science of bacteriology, we have never seen one species of bacteria change into another. Now, the evolutionists want us to believe that we've gone from bacteria to human being, yet in the history of science, we've never even seen one species of bacteria change into another species. So the transitional links are missing, and they're missing all through the living world.
And, of course, then they came up with some sort of an alternative theory of, you know, if we couldn't explain this on the basis of, you know, this gradual evolution, there had to be some dramatic change. And what was the idea of something? Didn't they call it the horrible monster explanation for the absence of missing links?
Yeah, that was advocated back in the 1940s by an evolutionist named Goldschmidt and a few others. And without the missing links, they proposed the idea that perhaps it was said that reptiles had evolved into birds. They said, well, perhaps the first bird simply hatched from a reptile egg. And they said perhaps through a mass of mutations that in one leap you went from one kind of animal to another. But, of course, that really doesn't hold water because even if that happened, to propagate the species, you'd have to have another creature which by chance is somehow mutated into a monstrosity, an identical monstrosity, and the two would have to reproduce with each other to produce offspring. And that whole idea was discarded by evolutionists, but it's one of many, such as, you know, the Peltdown Man and embryonic recapitulation and others that have gone by the wayside.
Well, I can remember this idea of embryonic recapitulation, I think it was the way. But anyway, why don't you tell our listeners about that? Because I can remember this idea that these fancy little slogans we learned in college, you know, phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny. I remember that. I felt so smart when I could actually repeat that. Phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny.
Well,
you want to explain what that's all about?
Well, I think that's why William F. Buckley feels he's so smart as he can say those big words, too. I guess it does make you feel pretty smart when you can do that. But what that was about was, you know, when I was going to public school and colleges with you, Stan, we were showing these pictures of embryos, and they were developing embryos, and you'd see a diagram, and you'd see a human embryo next to animal embryos, and they all looked identical in the early stages. And we were told that this demonstrated that we shared common ancestry with these animals because you can't tell a human embryo apart from an animal embryo in the early stages. Well, those pictures, they were not photographs, they were drawings, were forgeries. And they were created by the evolutionist Ernst Haeckel. And why don't we pick that up after the break?
All right, fine. Well, I think it's so important that the whole life phylogeny means, of course, the differences between these various a species at all recapitulates the growth of or advancement of the embryo. In other words, that when we develop as an embryo, we go through all these various stages of these earlier forms of life, starting with the lower forms and then gradually moving towards man. But they all go through exactly the same stages. Phylogeny recapitulates ontogeny, and of course, it was all a lie. We'll be back in just a moment with James Perloff right here at Radio Liberty. Go ahead, James.
Yes, we're talking about Ernst Haeckel's fraudulent embryo pictures and recapitulation. Well, it turns out that those pictures were fraudulent, and they were exposed way back in 1919 in a book called Heckles, Frauds, and Forgeries by Jay Asmuth and Ernest R. Holt. And they quoted 19 leading authorities of that day that these were fraudulent. For example, L. Rudemeyer, a zoologist at Basel University, said these drawings were a, quote, sin against scientific truthfulness. And F. Keibel, anonymist at Freiburg University, said, quote, it clearly appears that Heckel has freely invented embryos or reproduced the illustrations given by others in a substantially changed form. Well, that didn't stop Western educators from continuing to show us these pictures as proof of the theory of evolution, that man and animal were from common ancestors. Stan, as you know, these pictures have been completely exposed as a fraud now by Dr. Michael Richardson. He's an embryologist at St. George's Medical School in London, and he discovered that no one had ever systematically checked Heckel's claims. So he put together a scientific team that did just that. He photographed the growing embryos of 39 different species, including man. Here's what he said in an interview with London's The Times, 1997. He said this, quote, this is one of the worst cases of scientific fraud. What Heckel did was to take a human embryo and copy it, pretending that the salamander and the pig and all the others look the same at the same stage of development. They don't. These are fakes, unquote. Dr. Richardson.
And you know what really is amazing to me, James, is that there have been so many scientific frauds, whether it be the Piltdown man, or what was it, the Nebraska man? Is it Nebraska or Indiana? I can never remember which.
Nebraska.
Beg your pardon?
Nebraska.
Nebraska man. Would you like to go a little bit into the Piltdown man? Because, I mean, that was one of the most amazing frauds. And all these foolish scientists believed in this for 30 or 40 years. It was all a lie. In fact, everything is built upon a lie. And why don't the scientists come forward and admit it? Well, eventually they had to admit the Piltdown man, which I was taught was the missing link. When I went to medical school, when I was taking my courses on evolution in college, it was a scientific fraud. What about the Piltdown man?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, earlier in the show, you were talking about the big lie and how if you repeat something often enough, people will believe it's true, especially when it's done with the authority of credentialed scientists. And that was certainly the case in the Piltdown man. Now, the Piltdown man was a skull bone and lower jaw found near Darwin's home in England, and the find was announced in 1912. And it was said to be a genuine ape man, 500,000 years old. And the men who validated it included Sir Arthur Keith, the noted anatomist, and Grafton Elliott Smith, the noted brain specialist, and Sir Arthur Smith Woodward, who was the geologist of the British Museum. These men were knighted for their work on that, Stan, and they were all called Sir. And the headline in the New York Times was Darwin Theory Proved True when they announced the Piltdown Man. And for 40 years, people were doing doctoral theses on it, and people were told that this was our ancestor. Well, as you know, it was nothing but an orangutan jawbone that someone had simply stained to make it look old, and they filed down the teeth to make those teeth more human-looking. And they put it together with a real human skull bone, which they also stained, so it would look old, and it succeeded in fooling all those guys at the British Museum.
Hold up. We'll be right back in just a moment with James Perloff here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Perloff, and we're talking about his book, Tornado in a Junkyard, and basically going into the background of certainly of this fraudulent claim that evolution is a reality and it's proven scientifically, and yet we were just talking, of course, about Heckel's pictures. I saw them when I was going to school, and of course they were pictures showing all these embryos. They all looked the same, and one was a pig, and one was a salamander, and one was a human being, and then they went through all the various stages as they developed to higher levels, and you could see the human being looks just like a fish for a long period of time, and he had the gills, the fish, and then eventually those gills went away, and he became a human being, whereas the fish became a fish. And it was all fraudulent. It was all a scientific lie, as is with so much of science today. In the name of science, why they're trying to justify their atheistic beliefs and destroy the religious beliefs of the people. And then, of course, James was talking about the Piltdown, a man who for 40 years was believed to be a missing link, and it was turned out to be fraudulent as well. What about the Nebraska man? Because I've seen pictures there pictures of this full-size man that, was the Nebraska man. In fact, they even have apparently a dummy of him at the university there in Nebraska.
Well, the Nebraska man was actually based on a single tooth that was found in Nebraska, and the story was picked up by Henry Fairfield Osborne, who was director of the American Museum of Natural History. Now, Osborne was involved with a big debate with William Jennings Bryan over the teaching of evolution. Bryan, of course, later went on to aid the prosecution in the Scopes trial. But Osborne, the evolutionist, was quite delighted that this tooth had been found in Nebraska because that was William Jennings Bryan's home state. And a great deal was made out of that tooth. Many evolutionists proclaimed it to be a genuine ape man, and you mentioned the illustration. It was in the London Illustrated News. Grafton Elliott Smith, one of the scientists who worked on the Piltdown Man, commissioned a picture which appeared there showing these ape men using tools, all based on a single tooth. Well, Stan, as you know, when they continued digging at that site in Nebraska, they eventually found out that tooth actually belonged to a peccary, which is a relative of a pig. And it just, once again, it goes to show how people can be misled when they have preconceptions about something.
And, of course, they actually had mock-ups of this man in one of the museums there in Nebraska, all built upon the tooth, the finding of one tooth. It turned out to be the tooth of a pig or a peccary, but the scientists will cling to anything to justify their hatred of Christianity, their hatred of the gospel, and we have men who disgrace the so-called science and certainly evolution is not a matter of science. It is a matter of religious belief. It is a matter of religious belief that there is no God, and this is a matter of faith. And so, actually, today, James, aren't there more and more of the scientists who realize that this is fraudulent, even though that they have not yet accepted the belief in God, or those who have accepted the belief in God have certainly been severely dealt with, and many of them have been severely disciplined or even lost their appointments because they dared to challenge this fraudulent belief in evolution?
Right. I think more and more scientists, scientists are supposed to look at things objectively and consider all sides of an issue. And my experience, Stan, is that when people do objectively look at both sides of this issue, unless they're simply overwhelmed by the big lie, the power of the big lie, and the fact that so many people have said that evolution is true, but if they look at the facts on both sides and weigh them, they will come to the conclusion that life does have a designer. And certainly there are more and more scientists. I actually have a list at home here of 3,000 scientists from around the world who have gone publicly, taken a stand against evolution. And so it's very common, of course, to hear people say that no scientists reject the theory of evolution, but that's increasingly not so. More and more scientists are coming forward. Of course, Dr. Michael Behe, author of Darwin's Black Box, Behe's a biochemist at Lehigh University. He's written a book which points out that there are certain systems in the human body and others, organisms that are, we call irreducibly complex, cannot have evolved. There are many men like him, Lee Spetner, and others who are coming out with books that are demonstrating the falsehoods of evolution.
Well, I think that we really have to analyze this. And so many of the things we've been taught just were not true. They were totally fraudulent. I remember the story of the moths, of course, it evolved from being black moths to being white moths, And, of course, we'd even seen the pictures of the moths, and they were fraudulent, and they were actually something that was put together in an effort to deceive. It's all based upon deception. And if they're able to convince us, of the myth of evolution, what else are they lying to us about? And I really believe that there is a conspiracy against God. I think the other side is winning because they control the medium, but we have righteousness on our side. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is James Perloff, and he has written a wonderful book called Tornado in a Buck's Junkyard. Tornado in a Buck, Junkyard. And do you mind if we take a call there?
Not at all.
All right, fine. We've got Mark calling from Portland, Oregon, and we'll get to Mark here in just a moment. Mark, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I was just curious. On the question of evolution that you guys are talking about.
Right.
Do you think it's possible, in any belief, that maybe evolution, scientific evolution, is true, but that's what God's plan was?
All right. That is a very, very good question, because I can remember one time when I first got looking into this, I thought, well, maybe it was God guided this evolutionary process. How would you respond to that, James?
Well, I would say just the evidence against evolution would cause me to say no to that. Just the fact that the building block, the mutations don't do what evolutionists thought that they would do. The complexity of cells speaking against they're being created by chance, unless we want to say that God used that as a jumping off point. The lack of the transitional forms to support the theory. And again, what Dr. B describes as irreducible complexity, well, if we read Darwin's Black Box, we can get into this in more detail, Stan, where he demonstrates that systems such as blood clotting in the immune system are impossible to evolve because they consist of many interdependent parts that cannot have evolved step by step. Go ahead, Mark.
I personally believe that. I think that's true. What about the way that man just is a species has evolved? I mean, there's pretty irrefutable proof that we don't look the way, you know, we don't now look the way we did 50 million years ago.
How do you know what men looked like 50 million years ago?
Well, they found skeletal remains and forms, like, say, the man they found in the Alps who was frozen in the ice and different things like that. I mean, we pretty much know that we've changed in form, stature, and everything else.
All right, fine. Now, are you absolutely certain, for instance, what about the Peking man, the Java man? You know, or how much of this is real? And when we get back, we're going to be have to take a little break here. And when we get back, we'll ask James to address this idea that man looked somewhere certain ways 50 million years ago. And I'm sure you're probably referring to all these skeletal remains have been found, like the Peking man, like the Java man, and others that they will guarantee, of course, that are 50 million or more years old. Hang on there just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we have Mike calling from Portland, Oregon, and he's asking, well, you know, certainly man has changed. I mean, after all, the skeletal remains from 50 million years ago certainly do not look like man does today, and we find these skeletons with a very, very large head, much larger than we have today, and much thicker bones. And how do you address that, James?
Well, we actually started to address it by pointing out the fallacies of the Piltdown man and the Nebraska man. Yesterday's ape men have gone by the boards and they've come up with new ones. And, of course, it wouldn't be 50 million. The evolutionists might say 6 million. But the evidence remains extremely skimpy. And here's what I want to point out is that evolutionists like to say that evolution is a science, much like chemistry and physics. Well, you know, you take chemistry and physics, you can demonstrate the law of gravity. You can pick up a book right now and drop it. You want to demonstrate chemistry, you know, you can demonstrate that water will boil at 100 degrees, and you can test that over and over again. It will always be true. But when someone like Donald Johanson takes bones called Lucy and says, that's our ancestor, there is no way to test that. That's an opinion. It is untestable. It is unprovable. It is not repeatable. And what I want to stress here is that when we're talking about the distant past, you cannot look at the past with the same authority that you look at the present. In this sense, evolution is very distinct from sciences like physics and chemistry, which are directly observable. When we talk about the past and ape men, it's much like a defense attorney and a prosecutor trying to establish whether it was a murder committed or not. You know, you can't make the murder happen, the death happen over again. You have to try to reestablish the facts that occurred one time in the past. That's what we're doing with both creation and evolution.
So do you? So So it's your sense or your belief, scientific study, that 70 million years ago, that man looked exactly like we do today, same height, same...
I think very basically, if you look, if you find there's some little people today, and there's some very, very large people today, why, they've got a Chinese basketball player that's well over 7 feet tall. I would, simply suggest that you begin looking into some of the people who've investigated this, and so much of what you have been taught is fraudulent. We carry a wonderful book called Buried Alive, written by a dentist who deals with straightening teeth, orthodontist, who actually went to the museum in Paris and began looking at all these skulls of these ancient people, and of course with these different types of jaws. And when he looked at them, he realized that all of the pictures that had been taken were frankly fraudulent. The book is Buried Alive, and of course he was actually fearful for his life, because he had pictures and x-rays of all of these skulls, and everything that they had been saying for such a long time was simply a lie. But they can't let people know, and I don't think there's any way you can verify that people were around 50 million years ago. But Mike, all I would suggest is you maybe get hold of the book by James Perloff. And we don't carry the book Buried Alive, but I think it's an excellent book and shows how much fraudulent material there is out there. Because either you're right and man was around 50 million years ago, or most of what you have been indoctrinated in isn't true. You're going to have to decide that. I made the decision a long time ago. I was tired of being lied to by these people who pretended to be scientists, who sold us the Nebraska man, who sold us the Piltdown man, who sold us all those jaws that are over there at the museum there in Paris, and who don't want the people to know the truth, that it's all based on lies.
Why don't they want people to know the truth? What's the agenda?
Because, you see, if there are two alternatives. Either God created the heavens and the earth, or there is no God, and that's really what it's all about. They cannot let the American people realize that the simple story of the Bible is true.
The Old Testament, Genesis is true.
Hey, pardon?
The Genesis story is true.
I believe
everything
it
in
is.
The Old Testament is true.
I believe it is, but you don't have to believe it at all, Mike. But I think I just suggest that you read the other side, and maybe you might change your mind. Maybe you won't. Do you have a personal relationship with our Lord?
Yes, I do.
Okay, fine. James, do you have anything to say to Mike before we let him go?
I thought it was Mark, but. Let me just mention, as far as 50 million years, no evolutionists would say that there were men around. They would say that we departed from the apes or ape-like ancestors, maybe about 6 million. But if Mark might be referring to the fact that if you could look at people in ancient Rome, they were of shorter stature than we are today. And I wouldn't disagree that there are changes over time within a species or within a type. But we can account for those changes. For one thing, we have better nutrition than they did in ancient Rome, and better medicine, and people are living longer. And certainly there can be variations within mankind. I wouldn't dispute that within a species you can have variations over time. That's based on the range of genes which are in a race or within a species. Variation within a species or within a type is not the same as changing from one kind of animal into a completely different type.
I agree.
Which is
that's
what evolution says when it says we went from fish to man.
Right. That's what I was saying as far as the
thanks very much for calling, Mike.
I was just going to ask one more question real quick. What year was Rome founded? It's kind of city-state, you know?
It was founded about 500 years of the B.C.,
okay.
And then it lasted, and I think it was destroyed in about 26 B.C., and then, of course, they founded the Roman Empire, which lasted till 476. And you can remember that because, 476 and then 1776 when America was founded. Hey, thanks for calling, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. And so our guest here is James Perloff. His book is Tornado in the Junkyard. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I understand how difficult it is to actually turn your back on everything you believe. I mean, I knew that evolution was true. I argued against evolution. I was really an excellent debater, you know. I argued in favor of evolution and against the creation theory. And it wasn't until I suddenly had to accept the fact that I was wrong and the curse that I'd been lied to in college. And I really wasn't educated in college. I was indoctrinated. How about you? Did you go through pretty much the same
thing? Oh, yes. And in fact, I was a wise guy atheist. And if you said you didn't believe in evolution, I would have looked at you as a nutcase. And I remember one time a girl I was working with just mentioned God to me. And I just said, God? You know, what do you think? This is the Middle Ages, you know? I mean, that's how far out I was. And I was a hippie. And completely removed from any understanding of God at all.
But I think the trouble is when you get a college education and you've learned all of these things in the various ages and stages and times of all these ancient things, and they tell you, you know, about all the fossil layers and about, you know, how the, you know, you can see this, the whole story is laid out in the fossils. And if you look at the fossils, in beginning with one-celled animals, and then the very, very primitive forms of fish life, and how do you miss the people who say, well, certainly the fossil levels and the fossil layers definitely prove that evolution took place? How do you address that?
Well, by looking at the fossil record, and we were talking before about transitional forms, and we discussed them in the living world. But if you look at the fossil world, you know, you mentioned Cambrian rock earlier, and you know. Again, theory says we went from a bacterium, basically, to an invertebrate. Well, you can have the Cambrian rock, which is a very low geologic layer. That has most of the oldest known invertebrate fossils. You can find billions of them in Cambrian rock. But how many fossils are there showing that they came from a common ancestor or came from single-celled organisms or even how they evolved at all? And the answer is none. Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard, the late Dr. Gould, said this, quote, our more extensive labor has still failed to identify any creature that might serve as a plausible immediate ancestor for the Cambrian faunas, unquote. Faunas, of course, meaning animals. And he goes to the next level, from invertebrate to fish. Tracy Storer, professor of zoology at the University of California, in his book, General Zoology, says, quote, there is a complete lack of any intermediate forms the fossil record between vertebrates and invertebrates, between the invertebrates and fish. So they're not there in the living world, they're not there in the fossil world. Now, I'm not saying there are no transitional forms claimed by evolutionists, but if Darwin is right and there was what he called an incredibly great number of transitional forms, there should be a lot more evidence out there in the fossil record, Stan.
And they just aren't there. Well, I telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And then, of course, the question comes up is, how did the fossils come about? I mean, here are these shells and these other evidences of certainly very primitive forms of life, and they're laid down in rock. Nobody, certainly the other side, the evolutionists, never want to tell you how they get laid down in rock. Certainly, if they were living in the ocean, why, of course, they'd fall down to the base and down into the floor of the ocean, but they don't form fossils there. There has to be some sort of a cataclysmic change where, of course, these living forms of life are trapped in sediment and covered over. And that was Ken Ham has some sort of a saying about, you know, fossils or billions of dead things all over the world laid down in rock or covered over. I've forgotten exactly the terminology that he uses, but he's suggesting there was a great flood and these billions of dead things were trapped under the sediment. And that's why we have, of course, these layers of sedimentary rock that has these dead things in it. What are your thoughts about that idea?
So glad you brought that up. Of course, when I was a kid, I thought that the story of Noah's Ark was just a little fable for children. But you're right. First of all, 75% of the rock in the geologic layers is sedimentary, that it was laid down by water action. Now, evolutionists will say that that was just the slow deposition of sediment from the ocean. But you know what? There's billions of fossils, and just countless fossils in the geologic layers. Now, how did they all get there? Because when animals die today, in most cases, they don't form a fossil, Stan, as you know. I mean, either they're eaten by another creature or they disintegrate before they can be covered by sediments. Yet we have these billions of fossils. Well, Noah's flood would provide the perfect explanation for that, because Noah's flood covering the entire Earth would have churned up countless billions of tons of sediment, killing creatures very rapidly before they had a chance to decay or be eaten by other creatures who were dying and therefore could not eat them, and give us a perfect account. It also explains why we have so many fossils of soft body parts, like fins on fish and tree leaves. Again, there had to be some sort of catastrophic event that mineralized these organic creatures before they had a chance to decay. And the best explanation is the flood of Noah. By the way, early geologists, men like Woodward and Steno, believed in the flood of Noah. It wasn't until Charles Darwin's best friend, Charles Lyell, came along in the 1830s and proposed the idea of uniformitarian geology, that the idea sunk in the science world, that it had not been the flood of Noah, but just the oceans with slow depositions that had created all these sediments.
And, of course, there was absolutely no evidence really for that. Nobody was around. Nobody saw it. And that was their explanation. Well, then, of course, there's so many other things that come along that, you know, people talk about, you know, well, we have little horses and we have big horses, so they must have evolved. But that certainly is not an argument at all. We have little dogs. We have little tiny dogs, Pekingese. We have these great big, pulling horses that they have, pulling the Budweiser carriages all over the country, the Budweiser wagons. We have little dogs and we have Great Danes. We have small horses, ponies, and so we have these gray horses. So people say these did not evolve at all. They're all within the same species, and there may be one reason or another why God created many different types of dogs and horses. I'm not going to try to second guess them, but there's no evidence at all that they evolve one to the other. Now, certainly they can, as long as they can certainly mate, you know, of course you could get a large horse and a small horse mating, and you get an intermediate-sized horse, who knows what sort of horse you're going to get, but, you know, you can't even reproduce outside your species, at least ordinarily you can't.
That's right, and the Bible says that animals reproduce after their own kinds, and that is quite correct, and that is a pretty good definition for an animal type. And there is variation within types of animals, no question. You mentioned dogs. Just look at all the variations you see within dogs. But that's not evidence for evolution. It's just evidence for variation within a type. Dogs are all part of one species.
And the species, of course, keeps under their own, and they reproduce according to their own. And all the scientists in the world who want to disparage belief in God can't change the rules of that God has laid down from the very beginning. Now, we are getting a situation now where our genetic engineering, where we can actually, you know, begin to put genes from a fish, you know, into corn, or take genes from a virus and put them into wheat. But I think we're getting some very, very difficult and dangerous situations. Well, we've got a gentleman. We have a gentleman calling in from Nigeria and Africa. Hi, thank you so much for calling. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you.
Do you have a question or comment for our guest?
I have a comment. I have what I think about evolution myself.
All right, fine. Now, you live in Nigeria?
Yeah, I live in Nigeria.
All right, fine. What are your thoughts on evolution?
I think that evolution is just a topic to overshadow the works of God.
I think you're absolutely right.
You know?
You won't get any argument from, I think, from James or from myself for that. It's a great scam to destroy our faith in God.
Yeah, and I don't really believe in evolution, you know? If they say that archaeologists have found skeletons and fossils in different parts of the world. Cool, it's true, because we have had species of animals that have lived before now. You know, the dinosaurs and all that. We have had them, and every day, animals keep on going extinct. Their species keep on going extinct.
I think that's such a good point.
So
they keep going extinct, but we don't get any new animals being formed.
Yeah, yeah. But animals keep on going extinct every day because you have different governments in different places trying to protect this species. They call them endangered species.
Right.
So if there are fossils and skeletons everywhere, it's not all about evolution. It's what happens every day.
Right.
You know, in 50 years to come, in 100 years to come, there'll be some species that will not be available anymore. So it's a regular thing about the Earth timing out. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Right, I do, and thank you so much. We're just about out of time, but I agree with you. We find species going extinct, but, you know, if species are going extinct, why are we developing new species all the time? But, of course, we're not. God bless you. Thank you so very much, and I'm so glad to know that you're listening over there. Good night.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, our guest this evening is James Perloff. And, James, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out?
I do have a website. It's not a very big website. I have to admit I don't keep it particularly up to date. It's called refugebooks.com.
Okay.
R-E-F-U-G-E books. It's all one phrase, refugebooks.com. It's not a big creation evolution site. You want to go to someplace like answersingenesis.com or the trueorigins.org for lots of comprehensive information. But again, the books are Tornado in a Junkyard and The Case Against Darwin that I've written.
And I think they're great books, and I really appreciate your taking the time and effort first of all, to write them and then to share some time with us. Well, you've got about 2 minutes to wrap up the program. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners tonight? Here in the United States, and now we find throughout the world, throughout Africa, there's an amazing spread, amazing opportunity we have to talk to people all over the world. So what do you want to say to them, James?
Well, nowadays, Stan, there's no reason why someone has to be fooled as you and I were when we were young, and there's no reason why someone has to become an atheist as I did as a result of evolutionary teachings. Today we just have a tremendous body of evidence from genetics and from so many branches of science that show Darwin was wrong. Now, you won't get that impression if you go into an American public school. You have to look beyond that. Go to answersingenesis.com or to the True Origins Archive, trueorigins.org. Scan the net. Do a Google search on creation versus evolution. There's a tremendous body of information out there. Darwin is on the retreat. It's a good thing because this idea that we came about by chance has been used as a substitute for creation, and there is an agenda there. The reason that Darwinism doesn't go away, despite the evidence against it, is because there is an agenda there, as you were pointing out throughout the program, Stan, to try to discredit the idea of God. A lot of people don't want to be accountable to God, and that's why this theory persists in spite of the facts against it.
Well, I think our job is to get the information out, and if people will stop and think about it, I just look at the individual. People always say, I want a sign that God is there. And all you have to do is look at animals, look at the sky, but look at human beings. Oh, the human body is the most amazing thing. The animal body is the most amazing thing. And if you honestly think that this just happened by chance, why, you've got a lot more faith than it takes for me to believe that God created the heavens and the earth, which I do. So thank you so very much, James. We always look forward to having you with us. God bless you. Thanks for everything you do.
Thank you, Stan, and for all you're doing, too.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you'd like to get our books, we carry James' books, Tornado in a Junkyard and The Case Against Darwin. They're both excellent books. We carry another book. It's inexpensive. It's, I don't know, close to 600 or 800 pages, paperback. It's called the Evolution Cruncher. That answers all the questions that you could possibly have about evolution. Each one is different. We recommend the Tornado in a Junkyard, and we recommend the Case Against Darwin, and we recommend the Evolution Cruncher, because we want you to have the information so you can look at it and evaluate it. There have been so many fraudulent things. And these people will tell you the Earth has been here for billions and billions and billions of years. And how do they know that? Well, was anybody there to prove it? Science requires that you can have a theory that you can reproduce, that you can show over and over again that is valid. And none of this has anything to do with science. It has to do with religion. It has to do with the hatred of the God of the Bible. So don't be taken in. Give us a call if you'd like to get information on evolution. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we want to remind all of our listeners who are listening that we are having an all-day seminar on the 29th of October, our yearly Radio Liberty seminar. It's going to be right here in the Monterey Bay area at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. We'll be serving lunch, and you're going to have reservations. We have to know how many people are going to be there, but we're bringing in Constance Cumby from Detroit, Michigan. We're bringing in Chris Pinto from Southern California, and of course, he did the wonderful video, prize-winning video, that got the New York Film Academy's Best Documentary Award, and there were almost 1,000 various films were actually applied, and he was number one. He got the award, I believe it was the Tahoe Award, for Finest Film Documentary. The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, Chris Pinto will be here, and it's giving actually an hour and a half talk, and we have other people that are going to be. We've got a great lineup of speakers, and we hope you can come. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you haven't read my book, I think it's fundamental to understanding everything going on today. It's Brotherhood of Darkness. And it's in about its 10th printing, Brotherhood of Darkness. And, then, of course, we have it in video, or we have it in DVD as well, if you'd rather just watch the story. But having the book gives you all the sources of documentation that you can begin to check out and find if what I'm telling you is true. We carry Professor Quigley's long-suppressed book, Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World in Our Time, and you can get that by itself, or what we call the Brotherhood of Darkness, pardon me, Tragedy and Hope Special, which includes the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and the interview with Professor Quigley. And then, of course, we have books on health. Certainly we recommend Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, because there's an organized effort to destroy the health of the American people. And while our young men are overseas fighting for freedom in Iraq and Afghanistan, they are poisoning our children here in America today. And if you think that sounds like an amazing charge or bordering on the ridiculous, we suggest you get Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, or his book entitled Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills. Or you can get our material on fluoride, our material on mercury. Understand, they're poisoning our children. And your job is to get the material and help us to disseminate it across America. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please go to our webpage at www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Encourage others to listen to our programs. And if you're in a position to help us financially, we'd certainly appreciate hearing from you. We need to maintain the network that we have with almost 60 outlets every single week somewhere in America. So please pray for America and pray for revival, because it's truly a spiritual battle. It is a conspiracy against God. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guests. And our guest this next hour is Andrew Skousen, who's worked with his father, Joel, and on the world, World Affairs Brief. And if you don't go to World Affairs Brief, you're missing, I think, one of the best summaries of contemporary news. Every morning, first thing I do after my shower is go to my emails, and then I go to World Affairs Brief, and I try to get it every day, and I print the articles that are really of interest to me. But you get an excellent overview of what's going on, and Andrew is one of the researchers that works with Joel to keep that website up to date and to bring you the information from all over the world that you wouldn't be able to get otherwise. So without further ado, let's go to Andrew Skousen. Hi, Andrew. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening, Dr. Stan. Pleasure to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. And we're certainly living in strange and exciting and dangerous times, aren't we?
It's certainly true. And nowhere is that more obvious than this this past week's round of news, but with what has happened with North Korea and also what is kind of happening under the radar of that big news with the Military Commissions Act getting passed by Congress and all of that.
And I don't think that the average individual has any grasp of what the Military Commissions Act is, its implications, as we move from being a free society to a society where anybody can be arrested for being critical of the government. Of course, they say, well, giving aid to the enemy by encouraging the enemy. But, you know, anybody who criticizes the government is obviously giving aid to the enemy. And the question is, do we really have an enemy? Is Islamic terrorism really going to destroy America? Are there Islamic terrorists all over our country intent upon destroying our way of life? And if there are, why has the president steadfastly refused to close the southern border? And why have there been no acts of terrorism here in the United States since 9/11, no significant acts of terrorism? If there are all these terrorists who threaten us here, and since most of the people that we're fighting over in Afghanistan and in Iraq are people who do look upon the Americans as occupiers, and as the recently released government report on terror, it was released just this last week, stated that what we are doing in Iraq is actually increasing terrorism. Maybe we're not being told the truth about what's going on, but you pick the story up, Andrew, and tell us what your concerns are.
Well, those are some excellent points. I absolutely agree with you that it's not clear how much of a Islamic terror threat we actually have here. But one thing is for certain, with the actions that were taken in Iraq and the actions that, at least here at the World Affairs Brief, we think are going to happen in Iran, it's pretty clear that we will eventually have an Islamic threat against us just because we're creating it.
We're creating, in many ways, the best enemies that our foreign policy, our money can buy. After all, who's financing the Taliban who are coming in from Pakistan and killing our forces in Afghanistan? Why, your tax money, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, after all, we're giving Pakistan something like $600 million a year, and they finance their intelligence. That's the ISI. And ISI has always funded the Taliban, who, of course, using Pakistan as a sanctuary, just like, of course, the Viet Cong used Laos and Cambodia. We give them the sanctuary, we finance the people who are financing our enemies, and we're killing American boys. Well, Andrew, you pick up the story.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. There is, in fact, true hard evidence indicating that the U.S. has been financing the Pakistani ISI, basically the FBI of Pakistan. The ISI, as reported by the India Tribune, says that claiming to have cracked the July 11th train blast cases, the Mumbai police lays the blame on Pakistan's ISI and several other organizations. Mumbai's police commissioner told reporters today that the blasts were masterminded by the ISI and carried out by LET.
Now, these are actually attacks in India, aren't they?
It's true. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
A little bit of background on that. Yes, these are attacks that occurred in India, carried out by ISI and supposedly blamed on Al-Qaeda. A British analyst has raised a fair amount of ruckus about this. He recently revealed details about a U.S. payoff scheme that was meant to channel $70 to $80 million a month to Pakistan's ruler, Pervez Musharraf, as an inducement to produce a high body count of terrorists killed in action. It's difficult, of course, to find evidence that the Pakistani military has been really killing terrorists, but one thing is clear, that the ISI has maintained close relationships with Taliban exiles.
Well, of course, additionally, it was the Pakistani intelligence financed by the CIA that created the Taliban. In fact, this was back in 1994, and of course, the Taliban and Saudi Arabia and the CIA financed the Taliban. And America continued financing the Taliban under the guise of humanitarian aid right up until September 11th. And for those who would question that, you can go to the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and get President Bush's September 20th, 2001, speech to the Congress, to the public. And there he tells you that the United States is the largest source of humanitarian aid for the Taliban. And, of course, pardon me, for Afghanistan, and, of course, at that time, Afghanistan was controlled by the Taliban. So, in effect, as of September 20th of 2001, while the Taliban was hosting Osama bin Laden and giving him refuge, we were financing the Taliban. Doesn't make any sense, does it?
It doesn't, unless you unless you consider the fact that we've been trying to create an Islamic
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Andrew Skousen. And Andrew was just wondering if maybe we were trying to create an Islamic terrorist threat to justify going to war. But you picked the story up.
Well, and not only to justify war, but also to justify many of the changes in politics that have occurred here in the United States itself, especially with legislation. In an excellent piece about the Military Commissions Act, Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, picks apart what the Military Commissions Act does. One of the things that he says, he actually traces some of the history of the president's usurpation of power because of what happened with 9/11. He says, first, the authorization to use military force, he obtained from Congress the right to go after those involved with 9/11. Then he issued an executive order in November of 2001 granting him the authority to detain indefinitely without charges any non-citizen allegedly involved in terrorism. Not just those supposedly connected to 9/11, any non-citizen allegedly involved in terrorism. Subsequently, he claimed the power as commander-in-chief to detain anyone, citizen or not, allegedly involved in terrorism, or who might be giving support to those who attacked the United States. The administration argued that those so detained could be held forever, never charged, and except for U.S. citizens denied habeas corpus. These are steps that have been taken since 9/11 that could not have happened without the events of 9/11, scaring everyone into this threat of terrorists, and thus provoking them to give carte blanche powers like this to Congress. Now, although these powers have been acted and used by the president and by the government, they haven't ever been solidly defined in a legislative document until now, with the passage of the Military Commissions Act. I'd like to get into some of the details about why this act is so dangerous for all of our fundamental rights as protected in the Constitution, or as supposedly protected in the Constitution, but which are being eroded by this legal language that is being sewn into this Military Commissions Act that was just last week, I believe, passed by Congress.
And, of course, President Bush told Congress, look, I can't go ahead and prosecute these 10 wicked terrorists that we've moved from our secret prisons across the world to Guantanamo. I cannot prosecute these people, these murderers, these terrible people, if you don't pass this legislation. I mean, if you want me to protect the America, you've got to give me the right to go after the terrorists. You've got to pass this legislation. And if you read the legislation, what they've done is they've changed the definition of terrorist. And now anybody who criticizes the government is a terrorist. Not only that, but once, of course, you've been labeled as a terrorist, you lose your right of habeas corpus. Now, Andrew, does that apply to citizens once they've been accused, or does citizens still have the right of habeas corpus?
You know, it's very interesting. This act absolutely eliminates the right of habeas corpus for non-citizens. It spells it out over and over again in very plain language. What is interesting about this is that it actually does threaten the habeas corpus rights of citizens themselves. For people who aren't familiar with what habeas corpus is, habeas corpus has its origins in the Magna Carta of 1215. It is the quote, great writ, which is protecting people from arbitrary detention, disappearance, and indefinite detention without charges. This is absolutely a fundamental cornerstone of being able to protect yourself from being secreted away by secret police and being held without just cause. It is essential to all of our ideas of laws here in Western civilization to be governed by laws and not by whimsical individuals. So let's look at this legislation here. I'll see if I can find the specific instance where Michael Ratner, once again the president for the Center of Constitutional Rights, who comments in depth about this, but talks about this. He says, the tossing aside of habeas corpus is only one draconian feature of the Military Commissions Act. Another nasty piece of the legislation authorizes the president, on his own authority, to detain anyone, citizen or non-citizen, anywhere in the world, whom he deems to be, quote, an unlawful enemy combatant, unquote. The definition of that term is, of course, broadly worded and would allow the president to imprison almost anyone. Now, if you are unlucky enough to be a non-citizen and the president detains you as an unlawful enemy combatant, you can never test the legality of your detention in court. And this is, of course, because habeas corpus has been abolished. Continuing with the quote, you are there forever or until the president changes his mind. Now,
I think what's even more frightening about this whole thing, Andrew, is that basically they have put an appendix on here applying Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says this: no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider any claim or cause of action whatsoever, including any action pending on or filed after the date of the enactment of the Military Commission Act of 2006 relating to the prosecution, trial, or judgment of a military commission under this chapter, including challenging to the lawfulness of procedures of military commissions under this chapter. In other words, what they have said is the executive branch of government has total control and the courts cannot review this. In other words, we have lost, we have a one system of government. We no longer have an executive, legislative, and judicial. The executive rules totally, and the courts cannot challenge him. They've taken away judicial review. I mean, this is the most amazing thing, because what it means, you have a dictatorship. This is just what they had in Hitler's Germany.
It is, and the way that they're getting away with this is they're saying, well, we'll take these people to trial, you know, and playing off that card, but it's not a true trial under the courts of law that we are used to expect in our society. These are military commissions, which, as you said, no court, justice, or judge has any jurisdiction to hear or consider any claim or course of action by these military commissions. So, essentially, these so-called enemy combatants can be held at the leisure of the government, and if they choose, they can bring them before these military commissions to so-called try them.
But they're kangaroo courts, because if you're in the military, you do what you're told to do, and if they want to convict somebody and you don't vote, that's the end of your career, and they'll come after you. So you're not going to get a fair trial. You're not going to get a trial by jury. You're not going to have an impartial judge. You're going to have people who are employed by the government who will carry out the government's wishes.
That's right. That's right. Now, getting back to your original question about whether this applies to citizens too, it does allow for unlimited detention of citizens designated by the president or by a military tribunal. In other words, the president himself doesn't have to specifically declare these. He can create a military tribunal which has the power to declare anyone, non-citizen or citizen, as an enemy combatant. And they will then have the right to unlimited detention of these people. The difference between citizens and non-citizens, I believe, is that citizens won't have a trial by these military commissions. So it sounds like it's a good deal for citizens that they will actually be able to be tried in court. If it ever makes it to court, though, and here's the deal. If there is no power of habeas corpus, which is the right to demand an appearance in court to have the issues that you are supposedly violating brought against you, if there's no habeas corpus, they can hold a citizen for forever. And so it's a moot point whether or not a citizen unlawful combatant can be tried before a military commission or before a court is beside the point. Is whether or not they can actually get to see the court at all, and this legislation actually allows them to be held forever without even a declaration of what evidence is being presented against them.
Ladies and gentlemen, there really are detention camps that have been set up all across America. There is a plan, and of course, you have to ask yourself why they recently authorized $385 million for Halliburton to build additional detention camps in addition to that we already have. Now, if you doubt that, you go up on the Internet, Google in Halliburton, $385 million, detention camps, you'll find about it. And then, of course, we'll tell you later how you can get the pictures of these detention camps that are already there, with the turnstiles ready, of course, and the rail yards ready to take American citizens off into the American gulag. Well, Andrew, pick the story up from there.
Well, let's continue with a little bit more about this Military Commissions Act. The final chapter of this awful legislation is concerned with the details of trials for alleged terrorists by these special ad hoc courts, which of course are being called military commissions. What many people don't understand as they haggle about what will happen with these military commissions is that people don't necessarily have to be brought before these military commissions. As bad as the lack of justice is of these military commissions, many people won't even make it be in front of these. Of the only a few of the 460 detained at Guantanamo, and not to mention the many others who are being detained and held around the world that we aren't aware of, only 10 of the Guantanamo detainees have been charged and brought before these commissions thus far. It's clear that with the power to not have to bring people before trial, they can just hold them forever and never try them. It's insidious, but there's more. Once again, quoting from Michael Ratner, he says, "Moreover, the president, under this legislation, is now free to abuse and even torture those detained, using the slippery language of this legislation. Many of the gross abuses seen at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo will be allowed to continue if the president says so. And additionally, this legislation says that those who authorize or carry out torture techniques will have complete immunity from criminal prosecution. Those who authorize the torture of detainees in the past will be granted retroactive immunity, but war crimes cannot be amnestied." Boy, I tell you, Dr. Fan, if we could go back in history and look at some of the worst government regimes and how they gained their power, I think we would see a lot of similarities with what is happening here.
And I think it's exactly the case. I think that in the name of fighting terrorism, they're asking us to give up all of our freedom, and this was planned a long time ago, and if you doubt that, you'll certainly want to get my September newsletter, where I simply quote Richard Haass, who in 1996 was Director of Research for the Council on Foreign Relations, or Foreign Policy Research, something of the sort, and he wrote an article that was published in the Washington, as I remember, the Washington Post, although they have no record of it, where he basically said that, you know, terrorism is going to be a problem. Now, this is 5 years before 9/11. We're going to have to have longer lines in front of government buildings, longer lines at the airport. We're going to have to have increased surveillance. We're going to have to increase phone taps. We're going to have to give up our freedom in the name of fighting terrorism. Today, Richard Haass is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations and a member of the Trilateral Commission, and I'd like to suggest that everything going on today was planned long ahead of time. They're using the threat of Islamic terrorism to take away the freedom of the American people. And what really bothers me is that the people are going along, it's perfectly all right to torture, it's perfectly all right to inflict pain and degradation on human beings, but remember, next time it could be you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Andrew Scouse. And Andrew, go ahead, pick up the story. And Andrew was just saying that, you know, if you look at the history of mankind, time and time again, tyrants have used, you know, a foreign enemy as a justification for taking away the freedom of the people. And the Military Commissions Act, which was passed here the last week, with the full support of Dennis Hassert and the Republicans, in fact, it was almost universal Republicans. Very few Republicans voted against it, and a number of the Democrats, including Senator John Rockefeller III, voted along with the Republicans to, you know, take away the right of habeas corpus from not only non-citizens, but potentially from citizens, and to create a system of indefinite detention and military tribunals, military commissions who will try people and can try military American citizens. Not only that, but anybody who is cited as being a basically an enemy combatant, and the definition is anyone who gives aid to the enemy, and of course giving aid to the enemy would be critical of the government. So go right ahead, Andrew.
It's true. And what's interesting is that there are people who are actually anxious to defend this bill publicly. There is a long discussion on NPR recently with a chronic Bush defender, Professor John Yoo. And there is an interesting rebuttal to his comments by a U.S. federal judge, Judge Lisa M. Clark. He said this: "The very idea of holding anyone without trial, without the right to see the evidence that was used to justify naming them an enemy combatant, and depriving them of the ability to challenge why they're even there, is so repugnant to a constitutional democracy that I'm shocked that this man actually claims to be defending American values." He continues, "I also quibble with Yoo's contention that U.S. citizens have the right to habeas corpus review." He says, "I have read the law," talking about the Military Commissions Act. "The president can form his own tribunal, which can determine who was an enemy combatant, not just an alien enemy combatant. The decision of that tribunal would not be subject to habeas corpus review by any other court. How easy would it be for a president to use such a law to make his own political enemy simply disappear?" This is what we're talking about here. This is what this law allows. This is the law that just got passed. And yet, Congress does not even have the authorization to strip away a fundamental right like this. Even Congress doesn't have the right to strip away this law without amending the Constitution of the United States.
Right, but of course the thing is, what really is frightening is the courts cannot review this law. They have prohibited the courts from reviewing it. There is no alternative. Once you are in the dungeon, you will remain in the dungeon.
That's right. That's right.
Go right ahead, Andrew.
I think that it's important for people to remember how important this is. There were a great number of people who were swept up and put into mass detention shortly after September 11th, back in 2001, of course. Thousands of non-citizens were rounded up and treated as terrorists, and none of them turned out to be. Habeas corpus was the remedy that got them out. They could go to court and force the administration to justify their detention. But now with this new legislation, non-citizens can be rounded up, detained forever, and never get this case and never get their cases into court. This is critical. Look at all of the non-citizens that we know around here, you know, honest, law-abiding green card holders, not illegal aliens, that are going to be subjected to this. Not to mention, of course, as we mentioned before, our own citizens that can be spotlighted by these special tribunal and declared an enemy combatant and never given a chance to appear in court. It's really a scary bit of legislation, which is now already passed. And there were attempts to keep this legislation outside of the courts, to be able to keep the courts from even trying to vote on this legislation. And we'll see what happens there. There's currently several cases that are being tried that they're trying to challenge that point of the law. But all I can say is God help us with this.
Well, I think the thing is, of course, Congress could even try to reject the law now, but the president would simply veto the new legislation. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Andrew Skousen, and we're talking about the Military Commission Act, and this should be on the front page of every newspaper, and people should understand that it removes the court's ability to review any challenges to this draconian law. I mean, this is something that even Adolf Hitler would have been loath to put in, in Germany, although eventually they did. But initially, you know, during the early stages of his move towards dictatorship, why, of course, he would have been very hesitant to do this. However, the current administration has put in legislation in the name of we have to protect the American people, put in legislation that deprives every American, whether they be citizen or non-citizen, you know, of the right to challenge this. And basically what's so frightening about it is anybody in this country who is critical of the administration could be accused of helping the enemy, and by so doing, you'd be considered an enemy combatant and be subject to the provisions of this legislation. Would that be a fair statement, Andrew?
It would, absolutely, Dr. Stan. It's a terrible bit of legislation. Joseph Watson says that this is our generation's version of the Alien and Sedition Act. Under this legislation, coerced evidence would be permissible if a judge considered it reliable. That is, of course, evidence that procured through the use of abuse and torture. The bottom line is that this bill is beyond the reach of the court's ability to declare these acts unconstitutional, which, of course, they clearly are. The first military tribunals were recently banned by the Supreme Court for being in violation of habeas corpus. Congress, of course, has no right to pass this kind of law, which is a clear violation of the Constitution. And the law is still illegal, even if the Supreme Court is enjoined from declaring it such. Of course, this fact isn't going to help us much once we're arrested and incarcerated in a military brig.
Or in one of the detention camps that they're building, as they already have. And ladies and gentlemen, they really do have these detention camps. And Joel has been out and looking at them. We have pictures of some of them. There are even videos up on the Internet that show the electronic turnstiles that people will be taken in there. These are not for animals. These are for human beings. They're planning on a massive program to arrest American citizens. And we'll tell you more about that in just a moment when we get back here for your liberty. Well, our guest is Andrew Skousen. Andrew, before we go on, will you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with World Affairs Brief and how they can get a sample copy and how they can begin to utilize the great information you have available?
Absolutely, Dr. Stan. I think that the best way is for people to log on to our website. It's www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's one word, worldaffairsbrief.com. And there they will actually find links to all of the news stories that we think are important to supplement what people are hearing through the major media outlets. Most people don't have time, of course, to go and search through the entire Internet for all of the news sites. But we have researchers that attempt to do that and bring to light the important aspects and additional commentary about the news that is critical for us to have a well-rounded idea of what's going on. And we provide all of that as short summaries and links on this webpage, www.worldaffairsbrief.com. There you can find links to the World Affairs Brief, which is an analysis of all of the news, and written mostly by Joel Skousen, my father, where he tries to actually track what is going on and provide some kind of explanation for all of these things that we see happening that seem odd or unexplainable, and he tries to point out in what direction we are being taken. People who don't have access to the Internet can gain a free copy of the World Affairs Brief through the mail by calling a toll-free number. It's 877-518-5000. 1-877-577-5888. That's once again 1-877-518-5888. And that, of course, is toll-free.
All right, fine. This is a very, very important source of information. World Affairs Brief website and, of course, Joel's weekly analysis is excellent. It's certainly the most economical newsletter available and vitally important for you to have to understand what's going on. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question or comment for our guest. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, I'd actually like to pick your brains a bit more, Dr. Stan, about these military detention camps. I actually live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and just north of this city, there is a very large fenced-in area just north of the military Air Force base here, which was actually listed or described by one of the guards at the gate as being a holding facility. And it's absolutely massive, and it's not in use right now, but you said that you've recently been looking at quite a bit of documentation about these kinds of camps. Are they being used at all for prisoners right now?
No, they're not, of course. They're just having them empty. It's the same thing that when they authorized recently, within the last 6 months, $385 million for Halliburton to actually build these detention camps. There's nobody in the detention camps, but obviously they have plans to do that. In fact, we actually have a video. It's called Amazing Clips, and on that you'll see, certainly of the efforts to bring out the truth during the Iran-Contra hearings about these plans for the dictatorship, and then you'll hear Congressman Gonzalez, longtime chairman of the House Banking Committee, saying there really is a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and arrest American citizens and put them in concentration camps. You'll actually hear him saying that and on this amazing clips, and you can get that by itself or as part of our concentration camp special. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, we have a concentration camp special with videos and four tape sets and other information and the documentation you need at this time in history to let people know what's going on. So we've got Bill calling from Syracuse, New York. Let's go ahead and see what... Bill, do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I've got a quick question. He said that he read the law or saw it on a...
He said he's quoting from an article put out by a Mr. What's his name? Ratner?
Michael Ratner.
Michael Ratner. Of course, it's an excellent article. I've read it as well.
Okay, I was wondering, is there a government site or something you can go to actually read the text of the law?
I believe that Joel actually covers this in several of his World Affairs Briefs, but it is actually posted up on the Internet.
It is.
I would simply go up there and search for Military Commission Act, or Military Commissions Act of 2006. That's the title, Military Commissions Act of 2006.
That's right, and it's fairly easy to find, Bill, if you're looking to read the exact wording yourself. We actually quoted from it when we said, no court, justice, or judge shall have jurisdiction to hear or consider any claim or cause of action whatsoever, including any action pending on or filed, blah, 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 against the judgment of a military commission under this chapter. And it goes on. You can read it for yourself, sir.
Of course, it suspends, the protections we have by invoking Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution. Isn't it amazing that they would never invoke that on matters of, say, the right to life or abortion or the other important things to conservatives and Christians, but they sure put it in here to suspend the right of habeas corpus for American citizens.
That's right.
Anything else, Bill?
Well, I'm just curious. Do you have any idea how long the law is? How many pages?
I believe it's an 81-page document.
Oh, that's not too bad.
Why don't you read it and give us a call, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so very much, Bill. And I think that people need to get the information. But, of course, there are a number of articles put up by people who have written it, and I know that, pardon me, who have read the legislation. I know that Andrew's father, Joel, has read it, and every time he reads it, he finds new things in there that are designed to take away our freedom. And why is a Christian administration so intent upon limiting the freedom of the American people? Why don't you go right ahead, Andrew?
Well, I think that that bill, even though he didn't say it, sort of echoes a sentiment that is probably being felt by many of our listeners out there right now. If there is in fact this kind of a legislation on the books right now, and it is as dangerous as you and I are saying, Dr. Stan, why aren't they seeing more of it happen? Why aren't they seeing all of these egregious laws that we are constantly trying to make people aware of on this show and in otherwise? Why aren't they seeing the government acting as a terrible authoritarian item? Why don't they see these concentration camps being filled if they really are out there? How come they don't hear about this kind of stuff going on? They compare it with the what they see as reality. And I think what people need to understand is that if government were to enforce all of the power or to use all of the power that it has slowly been gaining in the past, it could easily turn into the kind of tyrannical government that we have seen in the past in history. But they know that if they tried to use all of these powers that they have been gaining at the same time, that the people would rise up and overthrow them. So just because they aren't using them, and they're just kind of holding them in their back pocket and using them in small, subtle ways, you know, a few people here, a few people there, it does not mean that this isn't dangerous. It does not mean that we shouldn't be worried about this. Fundamental rights are taken away in just this way, in apparently minor, small, hidden ways, and then all of a sudden people look back and wonder, where did all of our rights go? And this is exactly how they are taken away, by slow means. And someday we will turn around and wonder, well, where was I when all of this was going on? You are here now, and it's going on right under your nose. And I think that's what people need to understand and realize about this legislation. And yet it's so subtle, Pakistan. At the World Affairs Brief, what we are attempting to do is a method of induction. We see the news that goes on, and what we try to pick out are small bits of things that start to form a pattern, and we try to piece together the pattern for people to help people try to see what is actually going on here. And it's a very difficult process. It takes a long time. It takes somebody like my father, who has years of looking for these bits of pieces of information that by themselves seem like a small thing. Yet when you put them all together in this pattern that he is observing year after year, you start to see where things are going. But it's quite difficult to bring this to people's attention because people don't have the attention span to look at all of the details that are often intricate and involved to be able to see the big picture for what it really is. People get lost in the forest because of the trees, and it's hard to pull them out and give them a big picture of what is actually happening here because they're all lost in the undergrowth.
I think you're absolutely right, Andrew. You know, we've already seen them. They came after, or immediately after 9/11, a number of Muslims who were living in this country, many of them, a few of them illegally, some of them legally, but they arrested them and put them in prison. They were the first group. And then, of course, they came after a man named Padilla, who was an American citizen, who actually they had approached to become an informant for them, and when he refused, they put him up on trumped-up charges, saying he was part of a plan to, you know, to create a dirty bomb. You remember Padilla? And he's still in prison. He's an American citizen, and he's there on trumped-up charges because when they finally indicted him, they forgot all about the fact that he was supposed to be bearing the dirty bomb. They actually said he had lied to a federal official, and that's why they're going to hold him and put him in prison. But it sort of reminds me of what Martin Niemöller said. He was a Lutheran minister who lived in Hitler's Germany, and he said, you know, in Germany, they first came from the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist, and then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew, and then they came for the members of the trade unions, and, well, then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up. People say it can't happen here. Ladies and gentlemen, they've even taken the laws, the gun laws from Germany, and translated them into English, and they are the official gun laws in Washington, D.C., as far as federal arms control, federal arms legislation in the United States that's covered by Aaron Zellman of Jews for the Preservation of the Right to Keep and Bear Arms here in the United States, and Aaron will get you all the details on that. Why would they translate German legislation and make it the law here in America? And why did the CIA, following World War II, help so many Nazi criminals come to America and help 10,000 escape to South America under Operation Paperclip? And maybe some of the same spiritual forces, those evil spiritual forces that energized the Nazi regime, are alive and well in America. In fact, it was President Bush's grandfather who was actually indicted. You know, at least his firm was, the president's grandfather worked for, Prescott Bush, was indicted for helping the Nazis. But nobody ever wants to talk about that sort of thing. So pick the story up there, Andrew.
That's right. Well, I think that you're absolutely right. There are people that are seeing the effects of this law, and even though they don't make the press very often, it is important that we realize just as it is affecting these people, it can affect people like ourselves, and it's only a matter of time before they decide to use these provisions in this act. I'd like to switch gears, if you consider it appropriate, Dr. Stan, to talk about perhaps a little bit of North Korea, if we still have time.
Sure, you go right ahead.
All right. Well, there's some interesting evidence that's indicating it's not clear whether Pyongyang is actually bluffing about their recent underground nuclear test or not. This is a quote from Michael Evans, a defense analyst. He says, "There was still no definitive proof that a nuclear device had been detonated at an underground facility in northeast North Korea, according to Western intelligence sources. For a first nuclear test, one would have expected radioactivity to have been released into the atmosphere. Unless perhaps the device was small enough for the North Koreans to have contained all the radioactivity underground. If no trace of radiation is discovered by the Constant Phoenix, which, by the way, is a U.S. surveillance aircraft that is specifically designed to sniff out residual nuclear traces. If no trace of radiation is discovered by this Constant Phoenix aircraft, it would indicate that the size of the detonation was more in line with the estimate given by the South Koreans, which was that less than 1 kiloton of TNT was used in this nuclear explosion. I think what is most interesting about this is that even though this may have been a partial failure of the nuclear bomb that they set off, if it perhaps even failed to fully detonate, or if the North Koreans even set off a large conventional explosion to fake their entrance into the nuclear club, it's still very interesting to observe what is happening with the U.S.'s response to North Korea with this this flagrant, in-your-face bravado, this attempt to force their way into the nuclear weapons group, and compare it with how they are treating Iran, which is of course much further behind, but trying to do the same thing.
Speaking about how the Bush administration deals with North Korea, that probably does have at least the capacity to create nuclear weapons, and Iran, which will not be able to create nuclear weapons for probably 5 to 10 years, according to the CIA.
That's right.
So why are we so concerned about Iran that doesn't have nuclear weapons, and we are unconcerned about Korea that does? North Korea really doesn't make sense, does it?
It doesn't. And listen to the words of President Bush himself. He said, "There was a better way forward for you. Here's a chance to help your countries economically. What you have to do, in Iran's case, is you must suspend your weapons program. In North Korea's case, you've only got to let international safeguards on your program." Imagine if he had said the reverse of that.
Hold up, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Andrew Skouse. And Andrew, go right ahead.
All right, well, I'm trying to point out the hypocrisy in the Bush administration's position on North Korea and Iran. And there's no better way to point it out than in President Bush's own words, where he said, essentially outlining what he thinks would have to happen in Iran and North Korea's cases, he says, and this is kind of a sly double standard for compliance that he brings up here. He says, in Iran's cases, that you've suspended your weapons program. In North Korea's case, that you've got international safeguards on your program. Imagine if he had said the same thing. Can you imagine if President Bush were to say that North Korea has to suspend their weapons program completely before they even sit down to the talks? They have to show that they've completely suspended them. And what if in the case of Iran, he merely said, well, it's all right if you guys continue with your nuclear reactor development as long as you let international safeguards be put on your program. You see the contradiction here. It's absolutely glaring. And some of the reporters who were questioning President Bush actually brought to light some interesting contradictions with what he said previously about North Korea. And it highlights the fact that for years, the Clinton and Bush administrations have been speaking tough against North Korea and never following through. For instance, a reporter cornered President Bush with this question. He said, on May 23, 2003, sir, you said, you effectively drew a line in the sand. You said, quote, we will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea, unquote. And yet, now it appears that they have crossed that line. And I'm wondering, what now, sir, do you say to both the American people and the international community, vis-a-vis what has happened over the last 48 hours? And, of course, President Bush goes on to evade that. He says, oh, I appreciate that. I think it's very important for the American people and North Korea to understand that statement really stands. But it doesn't make sense. If that statement really still stands, when do the consequences start happening? If not now that North Korea is, quote, a nuclear North Korea, well, then when?
Well, we've got real problems. We're out of time, Andrew. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. And I think that people ought to begin asking questions. I mean, why is it that we have constantly tolerated North Korea and really helped them since the Korean War? God bless. Good night.
Thank you, Dr. Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if you have any questions about what the things that Andrew Skousen was bringing up about Korea, the fact that, you know, of course, it would appear that North Korea probably does have nuclear weapons, why aren't we concerned about them if they really have them? Why are we concerned about Iran that it will not be able to develop nuclear weapons for 10 years, according to the CIA? But we are unconcerned about pardon me, why are we so concerned about Iran, which won't have nuclear weapons for 5 to 10 years, according to the CIA, but we are not concerned about North Korea that obviously has nuclear weapons at the present time. And I would like to suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that nothing as it appears to be. North Korea has been helped by the United States with foreign aid and with direct aid, you know, going back for many years. Of course, even, you know, during about 2002 or 2003, George Bush gave some $95 million to the tyrannical North Korean government. And then, of course, we cut off aid because it was obvious that they had violated all their agreements with the Clinton administration. But we allowed South Korea, which we control. We have troops in South Korea. We control South Korea. And yet South Korea was then allowed to give aid to help the North Koreans. And this is the same thing that has happened over and over again. You go back and you study the advent of Bolshevism in Russia. It was financed and aid and helped by people in the United States, just as today in communist China we're doing everything we can to build up the military and economic strength of that nation. None of this makes sense unless there's another agenda. This is why we suggest you get the books written by Professor Sutton, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And then, of course, we suggest you see my interview with Professor Quigley, pardon me, with Professor Sutton, entitled The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. That's The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. Or read the book that Professor Sutton wrote by the same title, which tells about how we financed the North Vietnamese all during the Vietnam War. We indirectly financed them by giving massive aid to Russia that then was giving the aid and weapons to North Vietnam. And then, of course, if you want to look more into the concentration camps, let me suggest either the four-tape set on concentration camps or the certainly the videos we have. One of them is called Amazing Clips. The other is Barbed Wire Over America. You can get them all together in the concentration camp special. You need to get this information. You need to understand what's going on. And you need to find out now rather than later. We have another great four-tape set. It's called The Impending Police State. That's The Impending Police State. Do you really value freedom? Are you willing to become involved in this epic struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization? Christian civilization is under attack today. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. The video we spoke of, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, goes to how we have financed communism and communist tyrannical states since their inception. The same thing would be the book by that name. The other books, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and then, of course, either the concentration camp four-tape set or the certainly the concentration camp special. We have the information. We have the details. We have the material you need to begin to convince others while there's still time. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will decide you're going to come to our October 29th all-day seminar at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we're bringing in outside speakers. Please come, bring your friends, and help us get the truth out. If you'd like to get the Berkey filters to protect yourself so you'll have fresh water under any circumstances, potable water, and if you want to get the fluoride out of your water, give us a call and ask about the Berkey products at 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection, because we're on the front lines of this truly epic struggle. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you again for another exciting 2 hours. May the Lord be with you.
Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great big beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It's Thursday, the 12th of October, 2006. And I guess there are a lot more people out there that I suppose, you know, Tom Valentine would call them hamburger heads, you know, folks, or mush heads or whatever, you know, some folks call them sheeple, but I, you know what?